Old Mutual Investment Group's investment philosophy is anchored in underappreciated quality. By championing the unseen, they seek out businesses with value that the market hasn't fully recognized. Ghost Stories listeners can expect to hear from a few Old Mutual Investment Group fund managers in the coming months as we look to unpack this approach. As always, you must do your own research and speak to a financial advisor before making any investments. Welcome to this episode of the Ghost Stories podcast. It's the first in a partnership with Old Mutual Investment Group, something I'm very much looking forward to because there is a lot to learn from the smart people who run these funds and who participate in the markets at an institutional and professional level. And to do that with us here today, we have Mihir Jakurti, is the lead manager of the Old Mutual Global Islamic Equity Fund, which is now celebrating its 10-year anniversary. So very cool. That's a nice track record. And that's obviously going to give us some fantastic data to look at. And Old Mutual Investment Group is championing the unseen at the moment. It's a campaign that they are running. It's more than just a cute tagline. They really do want to try and lift the lid on some of the more unusual elements of the markets. And something that I would agree is unseen is the appeal of these Sharia compliant funds, not just to an audience who needs them for obvious reasons, those who need to follow this mandate, but actually to anyone who may be interested in the way these funds actually work. And that's because of the way they operate. That's because of the underlying nature of the portfolios, what Sharia compliance means in practice. We're going to dig into all of that today. So Mihir, thank you so much for being on the show. And I firmly look forward to learning from you.
Awesome, man. Great to be here.
So let's start then with what makes a Sharia mandate different. I think we must absolutely just cover off the basics here because there are specific rules that you have to follow, right? So what does that practically mean? And what are you not allowed to own in the fund?
I think that's a great place to start. Often people want to look at the ESG angle, but it's actually very different. There are definitely overlaps. Sharia really is rules-based instead of being scored-based where there are some inconsistencies. There are two vital steps that investors need to understand, and the one is the core business activity screen. Core is what you're making your revenue from, broadly speaking. So we cannot own companies where the bulk of their revenue comes from alcohol, tobacco, gambling, conventional financial services such as banks and insurers, weapons manufacturing, adult entertainment, etc. So that really covers that list. Just to note, banks are a big one because if you look at the MSCI World Index, and you look at financials, whether it's in that index or a different index, it's roughly between 18 to 22%. So at a starting point, when you're removing financials, it upweights something else. Keep that in mind. And then there's the second test, which is actually a mathematical test. It's a quantitative financial ratio screening test. And there are four, but the important one is the debt ratio. And that is 33% debt to asset value or market capitalization. Like if you think about that again, besides the conventional banks, when you take that out, you delever your universe by that rule. And that's really the big one. There are other rules, but that is definitely the most important one.
Yeah, fascinating. And you've talked there about core business. So I just want to maybe confirm something there and bulk of revenue. So for example, if a company is making, I don't know, 5% of its money from something that is impermissible, that would technically be okay from a screening perspective, provided it also meets the quantitative debt screen, right? So just to be clear, it's quite a practical test. It's where do you make most of your money, right?
Yes. So well picked up, that's what we call non-permissible income. And that essentially would have to be removed. And that's a ratio perhaps that I didn't mention in the quantitative screen as well. So that's a max of 5% of what we call non-permissible income. So it shouldn't breach that, correct?
Okay, interesting. It really is a fascinating world. I personally do actually find it very interesting. But more than that, I find it particularly interesting to see how this affects the underlying shape of the portfolio. And you've already made some great points there. Stuff like banks are a big part of the indices, and this fund would be extremely underweight banks, if any at all, actually, probably basically none, versus your traditional indices, which would have lots of banks. And it really does take out both sides of the coin, right? Because you take out the stuff that has high amounts of leverage as well. You mentioned the 33% debt to asset value or market cap test there. Now, in a crisis period, that's interesting, right? Because it means that when things are bad, number one, you're not sitting with exposure to banks, I guess, which would normally suffer a lot of credit losses. And number two, you're not sitting with exposure to companies that have a lot of debt on the balance sheet and might be at risk of handing the keys over to the bank. So what does this mean from a crisis perspective, a risk management perspective? Does this fund tend to be more resilient in a downturn?
I think I want to talk about that to the numbers. I've given you the rules and now it's very easy to implement that and say, okay, well, let's put that to the test. So what are we observing? Largely, we're observing lower volatility because of interest rates that can fluctuate, shallower drawdowns, and faster recoveries. Now, when I say fast recovery, you'll say, well, is that recovery back to zero or is it peak to trough? And we can talk about that. But then let's look at the actual crisis period. So the one we all know, and I'm sure your investors are a sophisticated audience, so they would have lived through the global financial crisis, which is the 2008-2009 crisis. Right. So now again, you mentioned credit. Let's see what happened at that time. Is it a credit event? Is it a liquidity event? Because that can be very different. The MSCI World fell through that time roughly about 54% peak to trough, right? Islamic indices didn't fall as much. So why is that? There's a credit event happening. There's higher leverage. Obviously, you've taken the financials out. Okay, so that universe then does much better. But what happened then in COVID? There was a sharp drawdown, but that was actually a liquidity event, not a credit event. But again, if we just look at that crisis period, Islamic indices again fell less, right? Slower to zero, but faster to the peak. Now you need to say, okay, well, now we're also talking about recovery, but that recovery is not to zero. It's actually to the COVID peak. And why was that? And that essentially was because when you take our financials, I mentioned that some other sector is going to be upweighted. Given the debt ratio, you have asset-light businesses, right? And then tech was soaring. And because of that upweighting in tech, you found that it recovered a lot better. And then in 2022, there was the rate shock. Again, rates there. You're linking that to interest rates. There's a credit event. So mildly better in terms of a drawdown. And when I say drawdown, we're losing less. And then also, if we look at the 2026 Middle East conflict, of course, there are high quality, delevered energy exposures, which would have benefited. But overall, I've mentioned four crises, really better in all of them. It's really therefore a higher rates play, but it has a meaningful benefit, right? So what I mean is when rates are higher or there's significant drawdowns, the fact that your opportunity set to choose from has been delivered, it's definitely a meaningful benefit.
Super interesting, right? Maybe just one point to understand a little bit more on there. So when you say they did better, are we talking 5%? Is it 10%? Is it 25%? Not necessarily the numbers offhand for each crisis, but just the factor by which you are protected, I guess, by being in one of these funds from a typical crisis, as we've seen over, I mean, it's almost 20 years now, shockingly. Global financial crisis was almost 20 years ago. I feel very old now. What sort of outperformance are we seeing by this fund in those periods?
You're looking at about where in the GFC, I mentioned the 54%, and then like for like, comparing apples to apples, you would have seen the MSCI World Islamic to 42%. So both drawdown, but 54 versus 42, it can be meaningful because then after that, especially when I spoke about recoveries, you compound off a higher base, right? So that can be really meaningful.
Yeah, it makes sense. You're never going to have a complete protection here because at the end of the day, you're still owning broad market stocks, but that is a pretty meaningful buffer. And it kind of shows you how much trouble companies get themselves into when they have too much debt. And it's interesting because it also feels like what people might not expect, right? I think a lot of investors who don't need to follow Sharia principles would go with the conventional wisdom of, oh, the sin stocks are very defensive and you want to own tobacco and alcohol in a time of need and a time when the market is really tough, etc. And maybe there's some truth to that, although I have my own views on that, particularly where we are now with how much health focus the world has. But it feels like, and it sounds like all the other things you're owning instead and you're upweighting instead more than make up for the fact that maybe you're losing out on one or two defensive stocks because you've got high quality balance sheets in there. And like you say, capital light businesses, I think that's a really important point, right?
Absolutely.
Let's maybe have a look then at global equity performance, because I'm aware that there's been some pretty strong outcomes by this fund versus what I would call your traditional funds or your non-Sharia compliant funds. Let's maybe talk a little bit about your not just global performance here, but also just performance attribution in terms of sectors. You've already given us a clue in that you've held a lot of capital light, techie kind of things. But where is that outperformance coming from?
If we can just focus first on the fund performance relative to the conventional, because we've compared apples with apples in terms of index to index, same provider, same Sharia board, you're just using the rules. How does that look in a drawdown? How does that then recover? Let's focus on the fund. If you look at our fund relative to that same MSCI World conventional benchmark, then you can see that over 3 years, over 5 years, over 10 years, we've outperformed that benchmark, right? And then just in terms of understanding the drivers Of course, yes, you said I mentioned the tech angle, but it's essentially the last decade has been the structural overweight to information technology. That was definitely the largest contributor, but also that would have been upweighted in your opportunity set. The other interesting one was healthcare. One of the biggest contributors of the tech in absolute terms actually came from Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly. So there you've got this quality company that's making bucket loads of money and it's come off GLP-1 drugs. Competition is coming in and that's always going to happen. And the big lesson there is that nothing lasts forever. But we had a phenomenal run with holding Novo. And just a little bit about Novo Nordisk, they control diabetes and weight loss medication together with Eli Lilly. And if we just think about that growth theme, if I asked you, Ghost, is diabetes going to go away? Trends of convenience and what we're eating, what we're putting in our bodies. Just that alone should make you think, wow, there's a theme there.
And it actually captures the other side of the sin stocks, right? It's actually the health trend. You're on the right side of it.
Exactly.
As opposed to on the wrong side of it.
Yeah. So from a quality point of view, and you and I perhaps define quality differently, just from a profitability point of view, a debt point of view, where the metrics on return on equity, invested capital sit, these are quality businesses. And then value, well, we can question what is expensive and what is cheap, but there's also a good growth theme. And that's really how we make money for investors by looking at those components. Interestingly, after tech, it's definitely healthcare.
And bringing up return on equity is interesting because that's obviously one of the metrics that CFOs love to juice up by putting more debt on the balance sheet, right? The more financial leverage you use, technically, the better your ROE will be in the good times, not in the bad times. It'll go the other way very quickly. But to your point, you can own businesses that have got a very strong return on equity, even without debt, because the underlying business is that quality kind of growth metric. It's like extracting that final bit of juice from that lemon that you've squeezed over your fish. That's value investing, right? It's how much juice is still left in that lemon. Whereas the more high quality stocks, it's not like that. It's the whole plate. They have a big growth story ahead of them. So would it be fair to say that because of the rules in this fund, it has a little bit of a growth slant more than a value slant? Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. But then if you have that advantage of growth, then look for the underappreciated quality within that opportunity set. And actually, then you get a trifecta in terms of what you're trying to do. We were talking about performance and just on comparison against peers or benchmarks. It's not that the fund was a one-hit wonder. That's very important because sometimes in a year, you can have exceptional outperformance. Yes, while our mandate is a developed market mandate, if you look over a one-year period where EM actually did very well, you would have seen funds or benchmarks that have EM in them actually did slightly better. But over the very long term, I mean, if we're looking 3 years, 5 years, and of course, you mentioned our 10-year anniversary, then we stack up incredibly well. So it's not that in 1 year we shot the lights out and now that's coming through. That's very important to understand. It's rules-based, the way we make money in terms of portfolio construction as well. We're going to put certain constraints that are more rules-based than narratives-based, if that makes sense.
The rules-based stuff also does sometimes help with managing human emotion, right? When you're managing the fund, you can't break the rule.
Absolutely.
You can't be tempted to say, oh, I like this fund or this company. It has a lot of debt or it does something that is, from a Sharia perspective, you know, something impermissible. You can't do it because you have to operate within the guardrails. And that's not a bad thing. It's almost like a hybrid approach of a little bit of how ETFs work and then how active management works. And we'll get to just now what differentiates this fund within the Sharia umbrella. But just before we get to that, something I do want to understand as well, where is the bulk of the equity exposure sitting in this fund?
In terms of domestic equity, we've got no South African equities in this fund. This is a pure global fund. It's also global developed markets. From a sector point of view, predominantly US, and then you have Europe. A big part of it is Europe as well. Interestingly, depending on if you're a benchmark cognizant manager, is that Korea is actually different if you've chosen MSCI as a provider or S&P as a provider. So S&P believe that Korea is actually developed markets, where MSCI actually buckets that into emerging markets. So that's the one play that it's on the edge. Is it a classification thing? Maybe. But actually, if you do bucket that as EM, then that's where we're getting our little bit of EM exposure. The companies and Korea have done exceptionally well over the 1 year period.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And what does it look like in terms of US versus Europe versus some of the benchmarks? I'm guessing that the US stocks, which are very cash flush, are probably going to get on the correct side of your debt screen more easily than some of the European names where they haven't necessarily had a few years of rapid growth. I mean, there are exceptions. Obviously, there's Novo Nordisk is a perfect example. But generally speaking, is there quite a US upweight here?
Absolutely. So in the fund itself, we are underweight the US, but that's a diversification and risk management story. The absolute amount within the opportunity set, you're looking at about 68% US. So let's call it 70 to round that up. And then the balance would be Europe and other developed markets.
We'll dig in a little bit more just now on some of the other differentiating points here, but I do want to touch on one last question around Sharia funds more generically, and maybe you can speak about this one as well, but just the concept, the stream that people would be choosing to swim in here. So we've heard about the protection on the way down in a crisis. There's a good argument to be made that you'll get a more buffered approach here and you'll be compounding off a better level going forward. Fair enough. You've got solid upside from the tech sector. So when that's doing well, you do very well. And that makes sense. When other sectors with low financial leverage are performing, that also helps, obviously. So there will be times where this fund does underperform, though, obviously. Otherwise, it would be the perfect solution to invest in, right? Which nothing is. Under what conditions would you expect to underperform traditional equity funds if you are following a Sharia rules-based approach?
Definitely in a bull market. Right. So this fund would have a bit of a headwind, and specifically in financial led rallies. So absolutely, when you see that decline in interest rates and inflation isn't there, and then suddenly there's free money on the table, and then you've got this sharp uptick. Right. And while you mentioned the growth part of it, I don't think there's enough growth there. And then we tend to lag. But Ghost, I can tell you one thing from my experience in managing money. If somebody else is giving you 22% and I'm giving you 20%, I won't even hear from you. The phones don't ring in the office. Everyone's happy. It's really on the downside when something happens that, you know, how much exposure do you have of this? And that is when people start panicking. So 2020, even though it was a liquidity sell-off, what happens is the market tends to look for more safe haven, more quality. And that's why you get the high leverage company selling. Also, that was a bit of a nuance because everything else I mentioned was really linked to credit and to interest rates. I cannot sit here and say that this is, what do they say, a fund for all seasons.
Yes.
I absolutely want to partake on the upside. On an absolute level, but definitely on the downside, I think that's the protection you want. And the perfect investment is giving somebody great returns with zero risk. But that isn't out there, I would say, or definitely not out there in some equity product. That's exactly what we're trying to do. Give the clients the best return, but rules-based, not just from how we make money for investors, but also at the outset with the Sharia compliant rules.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's really looking to just give people the best possible reward to risk ratio at the end of the day. And there's lots of clever metrics that you guys use in your fund management careers to measure that stuff. And that really is the fundamental point of investing. And there's a lot of portfolio management theory around that stuff. So maybe for some of our listeners who are more familiar with some of this thinking, what ratio do you focus on in this regard? And how do you go about achieving that efficient relationship between risk and reward for your investors?
Very good question. And that's more in the portfolio construction side, but we manage the fund systematically, but it's an actively managed fund. It's not an index fund. And our process is that when portfolio constructing, what we've learned is that actually we want to cap the downside risk. We've spoken a lot about that. We want to give the best return, but at a given level of risk. So we use a Sortino ratio within our model, and our research is really based on that over the very long term and how that looks. The best Sortino ratio for the factors or characteristics that we're looking for within a company. Characteristics in terms of the underlying, what's in the value bucket, what's in the quality bucket, what's in the growth bucket, and what's in the momentum bucket. But essentially, we want the best Sortino ratio over the very long term. And then we weight it in a proprietary method with the short-term signals and the long-term signals. That's partly why we've done better in crisis periods, among other things.
You mentioned earlier, you know, your phone doesn't ring if you slightly underperform on the way up. And there's a lot of truth in that. People are risk averse. They're loss averse. They don't want to lose their money. They don't mind not necessarily making quite as much in a good time. They get very concerned when the world is on fire. So that is an interesting point. One last point around how some of this rules-based stuff translates into what you actually buy. And I was just thinking while you were talking about energy stocks earlier, is there some risk that you end up buying them at the top of the cycle when they are super cash flush and they don't have much debt and that debt ratio looks like they've made all their money? Because obviously that's the one thing with energy stocks is you want to be a a little bit counter-cyclical. And sometimes that means you need to buy them when they are horrible. And horrible can sometimes mean the debt ratio is not where you want it to be. So just curious there, how does that practically work in your life?
Again, I'm not going to sit here to say we get everything right, but I think it's very important for you to understand, if I scored every company with a score, and it had a value score, and it had a growth score, and it had a quality score, profitability, your return metrics, your debt levels would be in your quality score. So let's say we have our scores. What happens in a scenario like that? Let's just actually work through that scenario. What happens to that score, that quality score? Well, the company becomes more profitable. The debt levels may be higher. So you're getting a slight penalization in your score from how much your debt is weighted in that score. But essentially, the company's still printing a hell of a lot of cash and actually is doing well. So quality, great. But actually in value, if you've got forecasted value metrics there, well, this price is run. That's a deterioration in value. That's a deterioration in value. This thing's been becoming more expensive. So it either gets to its target price or it actually goes way beyond its target price. So that's a deterioration. Then on the growth side, well, how much more can this company grow? And again, that's where your forecast is actually very important and the metrics and the data that you use. So maybe it's at its peak. So you mentioned peak. So actually, then think we're at the top of the cycle. So there's a deterioration in your growth score as well. That means two out of the three scores have actually deteriorated, which means your overall score has deteriorated. So actually, it might still be a hold, but we're probably going to take some cream off the top.
So Mihir, exactly. That's where you earn your active management fees at the end of the day. As you're making those sort of calls, you're doing those scorecards. And that's actually a lovely way to start to bring this home then. For my final question, we focus so much on the Sharia umbrella, which is the umbrella you're standing under. It's the one you have to stand under, but you can make a lot more decisions than that. You can choose what you're wearing underneath that umbrella. That's how you manage the fund, is all those other little decisions. So what differentiates you and the way you manage this fund from other Sharia compliant investments? I guess at one extreme, you'd have a rules-based ETF, which is just following a Sharia compliant index. And then you've got the decisions that you can make to differentiate.
Because we are quantitative in nature and we are a systematic fund, the process is always evolving, evolving for the better. Because sometimes in this industry, you get bucketed. Are you value? Are you a growth manager? Are you a quality manager? In a systematic style, there are new signals that have better sign and we can track those and we can add signals and we can remove signals. From a process point of view, that's really our edge. And then that's on more on the bottom up signal generation. And then there's the portfolio construction where we have our constraints. We have our TE bands. We have our sector bands. We have our country limits. It's more rules than narrative. And it keeps us out of the noise. And most importantly, it works and it's delivered over the long term. So again, not a one-trick pony. It's done well for a very long time and we've got the track record to prove that.
So Mihir, thank you so much. We've really dug into detail around how these rules work, what makes these funds really interesting. I think for anyone to consider as part of their portfolio, obviously all the usual stuff applies. Speak to your financial advisor, do the research, go and check out the Old Mutual Global Islamic Equity Fund on the Old Mutual Investment Group website. I will make sure that the links are available in the show notes and wherever you will find this podcast. More than that, Mihir, just thank you for really lifting the lid on how this thing works. It's championing the unseen. And I think it's been a really cool way to see how you actually do what you do, particularly some of that stuff around the ratios you use, the factors, the way you score things. Thank you very much. I hope you've enjoyed this as well. All the best with managing the fund in a market that is always interesting. I always want to say these interesting markets, but they're always interesting. So good luck with that.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Old Mutual Investment Group Pty Limited is an authorized financial services provider, FSP number 604. The contents of this podcast and, to the extent applicable, the comments by presenters do not constitute advice as defined in FASE. Although due care has been taken in recording this podcast, Old Mutual Investment Group does not warrant the accuracy of the information contained herein, and therefore does not accept any liability in respect of any loss you may suffer as a result of your reliance thereon. Past performance is not necessarily a guide to future investment performance. For more information, visit oldmutualinvest.com/institutional.